Thanks for tuning in to Jin and Tantra. In this episode, we dive into the Taoist idea that the drive for material goods, and in this conversation, our work, has a huge impact on our lives and personal development, or rather, it has a huge potential to really screw them up. We discuss the drive for recognition and the marketability of ourselves, work as a major facet of our identity, the geography of genius, and creating a tool to measure suffering. We are continuing to work out of this book, The Tao of Health, Longevity, and Immortality by Eva Wong, and I wanted to begin the conversation by reading the passage that we will be talking about so you're familiar with the conversation. The brief passage goes, "When you are rich and powerful, you will find it difficult to give up material goods and fame. Not content with what you have, you will always want more. Being drowned by fame and fortune, this is the fourth obstacle." Enjoy the episode.
Welcome to Jin and Tantra, spirituality with a twist. The podcast that takes Tantrism, Buddhism, Taoism, Sufism, Kabbalism, Shamanism, Chinese, Medicinism, and all of the other isms we've been influenced by, and blends them into a tall, crisp, cool cocktail your spirit has been longing for.
I want you to get together.
Now, isn't that refreshing?
I want you to get together.
Hey, fellow G&Ters, those of us who like our spirituality with a twist. So Daniel and I are doing a series of episodes on this thing called The Nine Obstacles. It's a Taoist idea. And you know what occurred to me, Daniel? We haven't even talked that much Taoism of all the stuff we have to talk about.
Well, we started a little bit last week.
True.
We kind of got the ball rolling a little bit. It was a little bit more Confucianism-based, but there was a kind of a relational discussion on the two, Taoism, Confucianism.
It just hit me. You know, so what we ended up doing last episode is we were going to talk about family and potentially relationships and these kinds of things as obstacles. Yeah. And then the conversation went zip-de-dooing in this other direction, which was kind of great, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And it was our exploration of form and energy, right? Mm-hmm. What would that mean to both of us? So we're in the midst of these episodes. And in theory, then, I guess we would be starting back up again talking about relationships and family and things. But I asked Daniel for a favor, as we sometimes do. I asked if we could come back to those episodes a little bit later on, because, fellow G&Ters, I'm just going through a lot of very deep things where I'm being really deeply affected by these things now. And last week, I was probably a little bit more wrestling. This week, I'm pretty happy. But I'm just going through things that are really changing me in really profound ways inside myself.
Yeah.
And I'm being very, very deeply affected. So I thought, you know what, I just want to take a little time, you know, and maybe come back to it, because I'm having profound experiences, very meaningful things, very deep things for me, very touching things for my heart and spirit. And I thought, well, okay, I'll come back to it. And someone very dear to my heart might say, I'm processing. Mm. So I'm processing stuff, and like, I'm processing like a house on fire, as they might say in England back in the day. Meaning very well, very intensely, with a lot of like meaning and I guess you'd say what, like passionate desire to learn. So I'm processing a lot. So I just asked Daniel, hey, can we push this back a little bit? And Daniel was cool about it and said, hey, yeah, let's wait. We'll come back to that one later on. So thanks, Daniel, for that. We'll get it like after I go through this a little bit more. You know, what did occur to me though was that, you know, we record these episodes, we do some things that are pretty personal. And it's also true that we're in all kinds of moods when we're recording these things. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes like we're having good days, sometimes we're having bad days, sometimes we're having good times of life, sometimes we're not having good times of life. And we still do this thing. And I don't know, does that ever occur to you? I just thought, you know, we've had times when we've done this, we'll have our pre-conversation and like, it's not necessarily the easiest time for either one of us, maybe at some times, but we still do this thing, you know?
Yeah, we do this thing and you know, we're not trying to put on like a happy face for the sake of doing it, but I try and enter into this as neutral or excited, you know. Neutral is like on the bad end, and excited is, you know, on certain topics, or if we have certain people on, I definitely get excited to talk about them, you know. But generally speaking, I try and take everything naturally, meaning I want to be who I am, which is who I say the person that who the person who we say that we are on here is the person who I try and be. I try and hold myself to those kinds of standards. And so if I say that, like, it's very important to take your life as a teacher, then I have to do that. And I have to take the things that are occurring to me as the way in which those lessons are being provided for me to learn through, and then try and transmute them into something that's maybe valuable for myself to repeat or process here with you, or, you know, to that's worth sharing, you know, in that way.
That's interesting, because, you know, like, as someone who's we're both clinicians, we're both teachers, and like you just get your game face on and you just do stuff.
Yeah,
you know. But probably yesterday, like, you know, so anyways, I thought, okay, let me go through what I'm going through here, and then we'll come back to this subject.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm going to see it like even probably with deeper and fresher eyes, because it's very close to my heart anyways. You know, we talked a lot of episodes about this. I think it's really a powerful thing, how deeply people can affect one another. But I also, I'm being affected. I'm seeing things kind of through a deep prism. So so that means we were going to go on and talk about the next of these obstructions, which is, or obstacles, which is fine, because we got like five more to do or whatever. But, you know, not going to run out of them.
One of the nine things that'll fuck up your life.
Nine things that'll fuck up our life. That's the title of our book. Because Daniel and I have the idea of like writing a book around these things. So this one was interesting because we both kind of took it in different directions.
Yeah.
So I took it as money, material goods, power, success, ambition, these kinds of things. I think the book says being drowned by fame and fortune.
Yes.
So I took some of that stuff, but then I also went in slightly different directions when we were talking off mic about this than maybe you did. But so it'll give like probably a really big, you might say, round perspective on this thing or something like that.
Yeah.
So I guess in the power, success, fame and fortune things, I did think of the whole Buddhist theory of like the different types of beings. We've done episodes.
I did too. But we should give the paragraph, Eric, here.
Oh, if you want to do it, but I'm definitely going to rip it. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah. So just from the translation from this book, the Tao of Health and Longevity and Immortality, the teachings of the immortals Chung and Le, translated by Eva Wong, which is the text that we're reading off of. And I'll put it up on camera for those who are wanting to hear it. And I'll post a link in the description just in case we can, you know, get Eva some book sales. This book is a super interesting book. We will do a kind of a Taoism for Dummies episode here at some point coming up, just so that, you know, we give a little bit more context for what it is that we're doing. But anyways, at the end of the book, they talk about these things called monsters and obstacles. We've kind of been working on these over the last couple months. And so this is the fourth obstacle, as they call it. And I'll read it here, but it'll also be in the introduction of the podcast. So you're hearing it again, just to remind you. When you are rich and powerful, you will find it difficult to give up material goods and fame. Not content with what you have, you will always want more. Being drowned by fame and fortune, this is the fourth obstacle.
I had to laugh because we were talking about our attempts to create more and more content. I think the word was like hovering around in both of our minds.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? Yeah. Uh-huh. I was like, I could easily see why that would come into mind, because we were just talking about that whole issue.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess we'll see where I riffed it for sure. You riffed it in your own way.
Yeah.
It's true in the Buddhist thing that they have these things they call the jealous gods.
Yes.
Right? And so in, you know, Buddhist thought, we did these episodes about this. They have these multiple levels of being, right? Sometimes they call them realms, but I know you weren't into that word, right? You like more like planes or something, right?
Aspects or something like that. Yeah.
So, you know, they can be like basically like whole little universes within the multiverse or something like that, if you want to get big picture.
Yeah.
But the thing we were talking about in the episodes that we did, and I teach this to students when I do classes on Buddhism on campus, you know, when I teach these things, is that you can see this kind of echoed in the human world, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are people who are these jealous gods of the human world. And the whole idea of them is they're interested in power, right? Fame, wealth, accumulation of material goods, power, and so on, those kinds of things. And so, you know, that's an all-consuming kind of a thing for some people, right? And, you know, obviously in the, you know, the Buddhist world, that's considered to be really bad because it creates a whole bunch of negative karmic things because you just end up like plowing over other living things.
Yeah.
In the pursuit of these things. And you fight with other people who are powerful. You can think of like politicians and business people. You know, Elon Musk fighting with Zuckerberg or something or whatever, you know, these people mm-hmm. fighting with another. They're in their own universe, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They do things and it just kind of like washes over the rest of the living things around them and just things are like constantly getting tossed around in their wakes. So anyway, is that how you thought about it too, that part of it?
Yeah, I had the same thought, actually. I'm looking for the names of those episodes so we can, but yeah.
Okay, yeah, make the reference to it. Yeah,
exactly.
So anyways, that was like one part of it. And obviously you could see what they're criticizing is people who are overly affected by that. And that means you'll be drawn to these kinds of negative behaviors. And I guess, suppose it's a waste of the positive and the development of the negative or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you might have more to say on that part before I take it in a different direction. I know you're multitasking.
That's okay. I'll find it.
And I'm blah, blah, blahing. But in the interim, but like I was going to go to other levels, but I think you had more to say about this part before I shift, right? Or before we shift, right?
Yeah. So, okay. So, you know, you will find it. It says, when you are rich and powerful, you will find it difficult to give up material goods and fame. So I didn't, you know, not everybody's rich and powerful. So I think the obstacle in itself, I don't know. I don't have any of the different translations of it, but so we'll just, you will take this for what it is. For people who do not have, who are not rich and famous, which is the majority of people, you know, how is this still relevant? Well, I took fame and I just did a little synonym for fame, which I use as recognition. And that made it far more tangible for me in that people absolutely desire recognition. And this can come in many different forms. The most obvious one probably is that on social media, who doesn't want to have a large following or who doesn't want to have all of their pictures liked or their, you know, comments commented on or shared or, you know, I mean, who doesn't want to be a quote unquote, you know, influencer or whatever, you know, who doesn't want to be heard, something like this. But this is a desire for recognition, you know, and I don't know how you want to define recognition for yourself, but I think without, you know, I'm not going to look it up because who cares really at some point, but we'll do the Mary Kay thing and provide a you know, definition, a working definition. But recognition is the kind of like in my view for this conversation, a deep desire to be seen, you know, to be observed, to be felt, to be connected with, such that you do not feel like you're alone, whether that be physically, mentally, or psychologically alone. And so when other people like what it is that you are like, right? Like what you are doing, you don't feel as if you're out on an island by yourself. And so this kind of attachment or drive for recognition is absolutely an obstacle in a couple different ways. The first part is that you might tailor how it is that you feel in order to link up with how others feel or change the way that you feel based on how other people feel so that you remain in the same groove. You know what I'm saying? And then this is where we get tribalism from. This is where groupthink comes from. This is where, you know, you not having your own takes moves you into areas that you might not even realize that you're moving towards. Now, it's not to say like, I don't have the same, I have a lot of the same viewpoints as you that I've gotten to on my own. And that's okay. There's, you know, there's whatever, right? But I think what I'm referring to is like this desire to be seen. So therefore I am going to either say things that I don't necessarily believe in to get a rise out of somebody, or I'm going to wave a flag that I only halfway believe in because those other people believe in what I believe in. Therefore I want to stay within their good graces. And I think this kind of mentality is antithetical to what it is that we are, our intention in this podcast and within our work and our life in empowering students, patients, friends, family members, loved ones, lovers, you know, all the people. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like you took it in an interesting, I didn't think of it that way. you know, but I'm glad that you did. That makes sense to me for sure. The way, look, what I was hearing in the way that you were talking about is also that you're framing it in kind of a compassionate way too. Like there's a kind of a desire in people to get acknowledged, right? You know, and that's a sort of a longing. And so this is sort of a, maybe an artificial way of getting that longing met. Right. So I thought that was like, kind of like framing it again, compassionately or something. Okay. There's a kind of a, this feeling of lack and trying to fill this emptiness through this route or something. You are saying that part too, right? I think you framed it in a passionate way, but it leads to something that is obviously negative in the sense that you can go through and end up again, trying to tailor your identity to get that kind of attention. Right. And inevitably when you do that, you end up sort of truncating yourself.
Yeah.
And creating something kind of artificial, right?
Definitely.
It's weird going back to the episodes we did on Eric Fromm, way, way back when we were talking about his art of loving. Yeah, I want to say art of loving, I think is what he calls it. Either way, it sounds like it should be more saucy than what it is. But it's not about sex, it's about love, you know? And he does talk about that danger in the culture. You know, he's talking about that way, way back. I mean, I kind of, that comes to mind occasionally when we have these conversations. He was already saying like, there's a like a marketing element in the culture that's so deep that people will feel like they have to market themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
All kinds of ways to get those attentions. And sometimes it's even in really intimate relationships, people are still in marketing mode, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, then you're also talking about like just in the world at large, you know? We've never done something on like neoliberalism.
We've been hinting, we've been joking about it for some time. You know?
Yeah, maybe we got to do that. Neoliberalism and you, watch out. Something like that. Yeah. You know, so I mean, okay, it's a weird philosophy, but it basically says like everyone is participating in the market at every single moment of your life. You're in the market, right? And all life is just markets. And so you're constantly on the sell, right? You're constantly selling yourself. And like, I was listening to one of the guys I like talking about this. He's a professor at Notre Dame. And he was saying, like, you look at the social media thing, it's like the perfect example of that because you're constantly selling yourself.
Absolutely.
And then the market will give you feedback. If you get enough likes and whatever, you know, then the market will say you did the right thing. You know?
That's right.
And your whole personality is supposed to be devoted to like getting the proper number of market responses. But they kind of frame it like that's a good thing, right?
Right.
Because it's just realistic to think of yourself as a participant in the market, no matter where you are in every single thing, which is obviously what Fromm is trashing in the 1950s and 60s or wherever it was he wrote that book. But it's obviously been a problem for a long time. And the social media thing that you're talking about is just like even a more revved up example of that, right?
Absolutely.
Super fucking toxic. Yeah, I know people who've said like, I had to get off of it.
Yeah.
You know, people who I know who are good people, like smart people, who was like, I had to get off of it because it's just, it has a bad effect on my personality. You know, I'm not, maybe just because of my age range, I this isn't a thing for me. You know, my kids, I can see it.
Right.
You know, my son gets like, does a comment on some chess video and he gets a lot of likes. He gets super hyped. And I'm like, I don't care, dude.
Yeah.
You know, in that, I don't have the emotional response to it. You know what I mean? Because I didn't go through it. Other things I can respond to from having the experience more emotionally, I can kind of get it from afar, but I can't totally get what that feels like inside to him. You know what I mean?
But being meta, right? We'll go one, we'll do the Deadpool thing. We'll break the fourth wall. Fourth wall is broken. You know, like, we do it on here. I mean,
fourth wall isn't like obliterated in this thing.
It's we've obliterated the fourth wall. I have, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, with this venture here, our podcast, we do love to get feedback. We like when our work gets shared. We like when people watch or when they listen or when they email us at jinandtantra@gmail.com or when they leave a like or they comment or subscribe on the, you know. No, but it's true, right? You know, I mean, I don't necessarily like, I don't have a good day because more people watch or less people watch. It doesn't affect me like that, but it does feel as if what we're doing is being consumed. And therefore, if it's consumed, it has value, right? And I think that's the part about being recognized for something. Now, granted, a picture of your lunch being liked by your, you know, it's not exactly quality content that you're trying to put out, but it's
by the people you happen to go to high school with or something like
right,
that.
Right, exactly. your home economics teacher enjoyed your macrame that you made the other day, you know, like.
Yeah. Well, I suppose like that maybe what I would hope the difference is in this is like, I think it's true for both of us that we kind of, we try really hard to be genuine on this thing.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
We're really trying to do that. So
yeah.
So hopefully it's not coming across in a way that's fake or something, right? Like we're yeah. trying really hard. I mean, I was even in the intro to an episode like this, I'm saying, well, listen, this is where I'm at, folks.
Right.
So, you know, trying to there be genuine about it. Like, and we had talked to like before we started the episode, and I was like, well, I'll say something maybe about this. And you're saying, well, you don't have to bother, we'll just go on to the next thing. But I was like, nah, I'll do it. I'll go through it just to be trying to be genuine about this shit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's the fame part, the recognition
that's
part.
Framing the recognition part like in a way that will be more relatable to people, obviously, right?
Yeah.
I know, how was it? I mean, in the age range that we're at, we didn't see this, but my daughter had this thing called streaks. There were streaks. And I think it was on Instagram. But you had to go through and you had to like a certain number of things and always keep it going, you know, and she would get so neurotic about this shit. It was crazy.
Huh.
And she was like in fourth and fifth grade. It was a whole deal. Like people would post things and you had to make sure that you caught every post. And if you didn't, you broke the streak. Some like weird thing for, you know, Gen Z kids would get it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, you know, there again, it's hard for me to totally like, she'd be super anxious about it. It'd be hard for me to totally relate because I never went through it. But I guess you're talking to another Gen Z or they would know that what that
they
was.
They probably would know it. Yeah. I mean, being, you know, my age, you know, millennial, I grew up with technology, you know what I'm saying? And so like, I'm like right at the cusp of it as it's being integrated. I'm like, oh, cool. New thing. Oh, cool. New thing. Oh, that's a cool thing. Look at that. That's new. You know what I'm saying? But I think for like your daughter's generation, the Gen Zers, the technology, it's already here. It's already a staple in life. They didn't have to grow up with it. It's already a thing, you know, like, yeah, the phones are better and you can do this or whatever, but since she was young, she has already had all of the things that she would have wanted was already in the phone. Whereas when my first phone in high school, there was no text messaging in that phone. You know what I'm saying? Like I had to put it in my backpack.
Phones used to be phones.
Right. Yeah. Like that's like just right? made a call.
Just,
like,
you had to actually talk to somebody. It was really bizarre.
Yeah. Strange. You know what I mean? Like wasting my time. I don't want to hear your voice. Send me an emoji.
Talking to an actual human. Whoa.
Yeah. So I have a little bit of appreciation for it as it's been implemented into society. Cause I remember a time when it wasn't there, but then also I could see how it is. But I can only imagine it now where it's like, this is just how it is. It's a staple. And to me, it's like a toilet flushing. You know what I'm saying? Like all the shit's eventually going down. It's just how many streaks is it going to be on the bottom of the bowl before it gets gone?
Yeah. It's really interesting because from the very first episode, you've always had your eye on this prize, right?
Yeah.
So whenever it comes up, you're always like, hey, look at this. Look at this in your life. Look at this in your life. Even from the very first interview we did with Samit Kumar, right? It was like, this is like a thing we got to watch, how this is affecting people.
Mm-hmm.
And probably in a way that like, I would say, I got it on some level, but I don't think I really fully got it. I mean, I was paying attention to the psych literature and I knew it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
But you were talking about it from a much more intense kind of understanding of like the dark place associated with this, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
The darker places.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that was part of how you went with it. I went to, again, I think the idea when you just talk about the huge part of this being drowned by fame and fortune, well, most of us aren't. So it was what you were talking about. Like, well, how do I make this relatable? What is this really about?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? And so I took it a little bit more into the world of work, especially for me, when I looked at these 9 obstacles, I felt like that one wasn't the place where that one was most accurately represented to me seemed to be here, you know? And if the whole idea, these are things that can kind of consume your life in negative ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they're obstacles. I think they're also, I mean, I think the word consuming would be good for them too, right? They can kind of eat away your life.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, what a lot of people seem to get consumed by is their work. They may never get fame and fortune out of it.
Right.
But it's whatever their successes are within the realms of that part of their life.
Sure.
it starts to consume.
Or you know? lack of success.
Then it like obliterates you in another way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I hear what you're saying. So when I was thinking about it, I just thought of people that I know in my life who I thought are consumed by work, you know, where it just kind of eats them up.
Yeah.
And I thought of, you know, again, I don't want to mention any people personals because that wouldn't be so good. But, you know, people I know who are eaten up by this. And I thought what really does happen is something really similar to what you're talking about, though, this idea of either recognition or I would say probably like self-esteem again.
I would
up in a number of episodes. Self-esteem.
I would say identity even at its end.
Yeah.
At its full maturity or immaturity. It's definitely identity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I could see that too. The idea of like, I identify so much with this particular part of myself. This is the core of who I am. If I don't have success in this area, I'm fucked.
Right. Like kind of feeling. Without my work, what else do I do? What am I? What am I? What do I do? I don't know what to do without this thing.
Yeah. It's a really weird like political tangent with like Ben Shapiro, who's like just a jerk. Right wing jerk.
I won't even have words for.
Oh, you have multiple reasons not to like Ben Shapiro.
Multiple reasons.
You have all kinds of reasons.
Also, I'm not that far removed from him, actually.
In the sense of age or the sense of like
connection.
Know him?
Yeah.
Oh, you know people who know him.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you just like avoid like any situation where you might
have I'm not in personal proximity, but you know
people who know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So anyways, he's like, you don't have to know who he is. Every once in a while, some political figure will pop up here. And like, they were talking about in like lowering the raising the entire the retirement age.
Correct.
Making it 70s or something like that. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like Americans don't work enough for like long, you know, like we'll put the Social Security back even more. Trickles of Social Security you get that trickle down on you occasionally.
That's right.
When you're old enough that you've been paying to your whole fucking life that you really just deserve. But okay, we'll act like it's a favor to you. Okay. And so he was just talking about it, and he said, like, he tried to make the case, like, if you don't work, what's your identity? And correct. I was like, there's many other things under the sun, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Smart kids philosopher that you are. You should philosophize on that a little bit deeper and you'll find other things. But anyways.
Simple-minded arguments from a simpleton. Privilege dripping from his necklaces, empty brain, pockets full, poem over.
That's great. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're going to identity. I mean, he was basically talking about that.
Yeah.
Right. So for our quote for the show, you have to pull that poem out. We'll just have to pop that up. We were talking about having quotes from the show. There you go. Spontaneous verse.
Spontaneous Dan, you know.
Amen, right? It's great. So that I also like was looking, and I think in talking with the people I know who are consumed in it, I would also say the self-esteem thing. So probably both of those ideas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they just kind of get stuck in it. And then, I mean, I'm sure we all know people about this, where the demands of like people I know who work in corporate America, who work in these kinds of environments that have those kinds of demands, they're there like 50, 60 hours a week, easy, right? And it will just consume your whole existence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you get kind of dragged into these things. And then really talking about partially it's the money, right? And I guess it goes back to the first obstacle, the feeling of insecurity that the money is supposed to assuage, right?
Yeah.
Which it really does. Because you sort of really know at any given moment you could get bounced anyways.
You can. Right? The other part, Eric, is that I'm not going to say never. I rarely see people who live below their means. You know what I'm saying? Even, and I work with some people who are really, you know, they're well-to-do. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like even in that statement, well to do, I have a range of people who I work with who are really well to, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Fuck you kind of money. And then I have other people who are like just a normal millionaire. And you're like a normal millionaire. Yeah. Normal millionaire. nice home, whatever, not, but not opulent, not, they don't have $1 million worth of cars just chilling in their garage. It's there. That's not, you know, and they have this same thing. They live within their means. And if their means are
their desire and their spending expands to meet what they have the resources for, and then they're right on the edge.
Yeah. You know, you start buying other things. You know, like what could you think of? I don't know, custom cabinetry. Mm-hmm. Thousands of dollars, thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, whatever you can think of, like just everything is more expensive. The furniture is more expensive. The work, the carpentry in the house is more expensive. The property taxes are way more expensive. All the things, everything is the trips, the vacations, the clothing, all of it is just, it just inflates. So if you're making $40,000 a year, you spend what you spend on X. That's 10% of your salary. But if you make, you know, $440,000 a year, you're going to still probably spend 10%, but that number is going to be much larger, you know, but you're still going to live within those means. And when you are unable to make that kind of money to live within those means for your normal spending habits, you feel it.
Mm-hmm.
You feel it even at that level. It.
You feel anxious about your ability to maintain it, I guess.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because to you, that's normal life. And that, and for their set, you know, level of existence, it is normal. It is totally normal. When I want to go buy a pair of pants, I go to Bloomingdale's. Why would I go anywhere else? You know?
Yeah.
As opposed to somebody else, they're like, well, I have to go to like Ross or whatever. I don't know, TJ Maxx or something like this. Nordstrom Rack. That's where I go to buy my pants. But no, they're going to Nordstrom's, you know, or Saks Fifth Avenue, whatever. I don't even know. There's probably nicer stores. Von Maur, I'm not sure, you know.
So basically you're saying is like when you're dealing with these patients, you can kind of like assess clinically, oh, there's still this anxiety, doesn't go away.
Correct.
It's still there.
Correct.
It's still, yeah. Yeah, I, so again, yeah, it's so interesting. So we took, it's a big thing, this one. It can go in all these different directions, seems to be like the message of this for me, mm-hmm. right? And so again, like I went to like people I know who I don't have necessarily those means, not your patients who you're talking about in that way, but people who like still have, again, in ways, their identity, their self-esteem, they're still being drowned by their local minimal fortune and fame, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're trying to do for themselves to handle, again, like probably their own lack of self-esteem in some ways, right? And trying to prove themselves in these ways. Like I know people who are like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, again, they begin kind of eating up. And so then I guess the idea is then, what does that mean sort of like psycho-spiritually was sort of the next thing I was thinking about,
mm-hmm.
you know? And there are warnings in some of these Buddhist philosophers about these things. Like there's Kamala Shila, who's like one of these great kind of Buddhist philosophers, practitioners, scholars, you know? I remember like the Dalai Lama was doing a teaching on his work. You know, they do these things in Tibet where they kind of take one of these famous books and someone kind of goes through it with you, you know. So I had this with the Dalai Lama up in Madison. And there were parts where he was talking about this whole idea, you know, that your work can eat away at this. There's a similar idea going on there, right? And then you won't have the time to go through and, you know, do the other major spiritual things of your life, right? They'll be kind of like eaten away. And then you, again, like, as, I guess, as far as my gripe about this a lot, then you're more the victim of the culture around you again, which I always think is a mistake, right?
Mm-hmm.
That part of like Taoist to the core on, or tantric Buddhist to the core, or whatever you want to say, if that starts to devour you. I had like a little tangenty thing around that too. I'll throw it out to you just to see what you think. It's kind of related, like, you know, how the culture can do this. There's a book, I'm like, haven't read it myself, but I've been talking with someone else who's been reading it. It's called The Geography of Genius. It's this guy named Eric Viner.
I like the title.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I want to judge that book by its title, and I like it.
I'm judging that book by the cover totally, and I'm in. Right?
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he goes through and he's traveling on the world and he's trying to figure out what cultural conditions tend to produce explosions of like all kinds of creative work, all kinds of creative people. You know, that's kind of the gist of the book. You know, it's a little bit like a travel book, because he gets to go around and go to places, you know, where there's history of like great cultural things happening. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
But one of his points is, you know, and he talks about with the Greeks, and I didn't realize this, but what he says about like ancient Greek culture, when you're talking about like, you know, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and all these people, like apparently they didn't value money at all.
Mm.
You know, it was actually considered to be kind of gauche or something like that. To care about money, you were supposed to care about ideas, and you know, everyone was kind of basically in the same relative crappy conditions in terms of money. No one had a lot, you know, it wasn't like that, you know. And but it produced all of this cultural explosion because the values were just placed in this other place. And I thought, well, that's interesting, makes sense. But you know, his argument in the book is going around to these different places trying to make that case over and over again. The more you get the money thing taking over, the more you lose the possibility of creativity and genius, because all the energy starts going in this other direction, you know? And at least as far as American culture, he's saying, I think the underlying point, because he doesn't like it that much, so I'm going to be into that book or even conversations about that book, because I like to be critical of these things. But he's basically saying, you know, a lot of American cultural things, they're not genius because they're all just sort of pragmatically designed to make money.
Yes.
So things that American culture produces that you'd say have the quality of genius about it are usually technological, you know, and are usually ultimately a core trying to make money. And his definition of genius then kind of excludes that. We could debate that, I suppose, right? But he's using a definition that doesn't include that, you know. Wasn't Socrates' point to make money, right? Wasn't Buddha's point to make money, or Lao Tzu's point to make money, right? Well, so
my, you know, yoga teacher, Andre, would agree with that completely. Completely. I mean, he often makes the point that, like, tell me an idea that you have that doesn't revolve around making money or trying to make money.
Oh, he says that way.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. How do people answer it? Or he's not looking, it's rhetorical, I guess, right? I should say this.
Exactly.
Hey, Andre, I have one.
Yeah. Actually, here, I
really like to watch Pornhub a lot. I don't make any money on it at all. That wasn't what we were talking about.
But Todd, yeah,
like, but take okay.
Point, counterpoint, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, he makes that point. And he has, and listen.
But do y'all talk about it afterwards, though, when you're sitting having lunch and food? Do you kick it around? Do people come back to it, or?
I mean, it's, you know, with Andre, it's kind of like, you know, if you want to talk about something, he'll be like, what? This is absolutely true, you know?
No, I mean, like amongst the students, though, is that something y'all have kicked around to see how people react to it? I'm kind of curious.
No, I think people understand it as it is. I mean, he'll talk about bigger points, like, you know, if you say you don't have money for this, then stop drinking a $7 coffee every day. You're going to have money for that thing over a short amount of time. You know, like learn to, basically what he's saying is reduce your desires, reduce your expenditure, reduce your footprint. And you'll have more just by the reduction of other things, even if you don't make any extra. You know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, Kama Shila's point is something like, Shila? Kama, his point is something like, you know, if you do that, then you'll have the more mental space because you won't be consumed by that, right? Which is exactly what he's talking about.
Yep, exactly.
This is just something about retreats. So I was just referencing, sometimes what will happen is you'll be on a retreat, and then you'll have these downtimes during the retreat where you're just sitting bullshitting around. And I was just on something y'all had talked about when you're just sitting, you know, just BSing. Because sometimes you have some pretty deep conversations in those times.
Yeah, right? For sure.
Yeah. And the people haven't been on retreats. It's an interesting part of being on retreat. You know, you meet new people and you're listening to these lectures and you're hanging around and you get the chance to kick these things, you know, that you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a teaching retreat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Share your experiences and whatnot. So anyway, so this is geography of genius idea. And he kind of goes through and he says, wherever you find the money thing taking over, the genius will probably disappear. Mm. And I guess that, to my mind, that's related to sort of like spiritual genius too, right? Just as the podcast is kind of a spirituality that I think, you know, spiritual insights show geniusness, obviously, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, the more that this takes over, the less the chance you're going to have the space to do that. You just won't have the mental space to do it, right?
Right. Well, yeah, because you're tired, your mental expenditure has been expended.
Yeah. But also, I guess what Andre's saying is it consumes your mind in some way that it'll be there underneath the surface, right?
Yeah, and
I with a thought that isn't about this, you know, he's basically saying it's something about how your mind is getting constructed then, right?
The term that I use for this is habituated, right? I use this all the time. Yeah. Right. This is just a because it becomes ingrained in how you see things, you know? And I think people do it on a regular basis. We're always, I'm always anyways, engaging with the world as, you know, threat, non-threat, doing binary thing, male, female, you know, whatever, you know what I'm saying? Judging. And I guess in a way, judging or categorizing, maybe is a better way of putting it. But then we're like, okay, what are they driving? Oh, that car sucks. You know, like, you know what I'm saying? And there's a bit of this, but eventually it just happens even before it hits your level of cognition. And it does, you know, I mean, speaking for myself, I can't speak for anybody else's thoughts, but I don't imagine I'm that different than other humans. But for me, I'm aware, you know, I see this, oh, look at that. You know, I'm going to just use cars because we're always driving places, you know, in this culture. You see something, you know, that car's beat up, you know, they must not care about their thing or whatever, but it's just, it's happening this way. So then I go down and I do the rabbit hole of this person doesn't care to wash their car. So they're probably not concerned with X, Y, or Z, you know, but this kind of mentality that then gets placed in many other positions as well. It's, you know, something that I'm working towards to not have that as a thing for me. It doesn't affect the way that I interact with people, but I can say that the way that you do something is probably the way you do most things. And so if you're in a culture that is absolutely 100% a money whore, which is what we are for sure, that you're going to put the glasses are going to be green and it's going to be dollar signs, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's maybe not going to be like all of the way in which you see every single part of the world, but it's going to be a big part of it. And in this culture in particular, man, it's prevalent.
Yeah. And then that, like, you know, based on the guy's theory in the book, that works against spiritual insight, genius, creativity, and all these other things, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, as we get towards, you know, the more closing part of the episode, I was trying to think, well, what do you say about this then, right? And I happened to be having a conversation with someone today, very dear to my heart. And she was explaining how adamant she was in finding her work, you know, and she was saying like, well, it took me longer because I had to search a little bit more. Mm. And she said definitively, I wasn't going to settle until I found the thing that I found to be meaningful. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a different yardstick of making a decision. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was definitely like, okay, I could relate to that too. And we started talking a little bit. And for me, you know, I like, even if I go back to my undergrad days, I was willing to like go to do things and say, nope, this isn't right. I got to move on. This isn't right. I got to move on. So I did that a lot. It was like, it didn't thrill like my parents,
right?
People around me, but I was like, nope, this isn't it. This isn't it. This isn't it. And I was like, again, I had a kind of like a similar maybe adamance to it, right? Where I was just like, no, I'm not doing this. So maybe that's something by way of at least a shared experience that might resonate with other people too, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe you have to like find that part of yourself.
And it's then, true. You know,
make it like right livelihood in the Buddhist sense. I'm not going to be satisfied till I got the one that seems like I'm cool with it. And even if it takes some time, takes some difficulty, I'll keep pushing at this thing till I find it. And then that would be my way of solving this problem. I still have to be realistic and I have to make some money and do these things, but of I'm going to keep pushing until I get to the thing that I feel comfortable, you know, with. So maybe that's the piece of advice behind it. I don't know. What do you think?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think we're always cognizant of the variety of people's life experience. And so if you have responsibilities, if you would have had, you know, children at a much younger age, that might have been more difficult or taken you more time, but I don't think that would have made you choose differently. It would have just
I wouldn't have done that, to be honest. I wouldn't have done some of the things I did until I knew this was set up and I was satisfied with it. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Well, that's a personal choice, but yeah.
And sometimes things happen or what, you know, whatever, you have to inherit somebody's, you know, I had a friend of mine, he raised his sister's child because she couldn't do it. She was an alcoholic, just, you know, and she had a kid at a young age. And so her younger brother had to raise this kid when he was probably 20, maybe. When he started raising his, you know, what's effectively his son, but it was his nephew. So there's some circumstances that come, you know, that come up. But I think more to your point, that has to be an organizing factor in your life. And even in the circumstances that you might be handed, because everyone's circumstances are different, that you can still make those efforts. You know, you can still have it in your life. And so sometimes, you know, we got to suck it up. Like that's just what it is. You know, like life gives you lemons, you know, but that doesn't mean that you have to like be beaten into the point that you no longer, that flame gets extinguished, you know, and you're like, well, this is just my lot. Like, no, it's not. It's not your lot. Like you'll continue. Like I was having a conversation with a friend of mine and he was like, oh, why don't you do this type of treatment? You know? And I was like, oh, those people make a lot of money. And he goes, well, maybe he goes, you could totally do that. You know? And I said, that's not what I want to do. He's like, you could do what you want to do, you know, make a few hundred thousand a year. And then later on you can go back and do passion projects. And I was like, no.
Yeah. I had that personality too.
I can't do that. I could, but I choose not to, you know, I won't do that. I would have gone into finance if that was the case, you know, which is infinitely interesting to me, but not rewarding.
I like had my best friend growing up, one of my best friends growing up. And when he went to work in corporate America, it was a very interesting thing for me to watch. I think maybe we've talked about it here or there.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I'm amazed this motherfucker can do this. This would kill me. This would destroy my soul.
Yeah.
But he was just la, 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 going along. Like it was nothing. And I had to realize like, okay, we have very different personalities then.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We have very different personalities. But if you feel this thing that like, if you have this concern, if you're listening to this thing,
yeah,
you're like, okay, I want to work psychospiritually on myself. I'm recognizing this as a part of life that can be a problem. Cause that's what the Taoists seem to be saying. Yep. Right. If we extrapolate it out,
yeah,
then maybe that's what this entails. Like going through and saying, okay, I'm gonna be driven in this way. I'm not gonna be satisfied. Doesn't have to be perfect, obviously. Perfection is the perfect is the enemy of the good, as they say, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at least you can be like, okay, this I can believe in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at one point for one of the schools I teach, Pacific College, they asked me to write an essay about why I went into doing this. And I was kind of inspired by the story of the Zen master Amori Sogen. So he's a kind of interesting character. He was kind of almost part of this Japanese samurai class of people, you know, before World War II. And in the aftermath, he felt all of this shame because he felt like people like him were the things that led to like the tragedies of that war. You know, he was like, I was too invested in Japanese nationalism or something like that. I was too connected to it. And maybe not in the way I even like wanted to be, but the way I was like blinded in a way, you know what I mean? I think that's how he talks about it. I hope I'm doing full justice to how he describes it. But in the end, he was like, after the war, he was going to commit like ritual suicide. He was going to do seppuku because he was just like, ugh, I feel so bad about myself, you know? And then he had a teacher who said, no, you can't do that. No, you don't. That's the easy way out in this. No, no, you have to go through and you have to contribute something back, right? Mm-hmm. And we need people like you to do this. So the fascinating thing about him was then he became a Zen master. He was already sort of a martial arts master. You know, he was involved mm-hmm. in that part of Japanese culture. But then he became a university professor. He became a fine arts person. I remember seeing exhibits of his work up in Wisconsin. Again, it wasn't the same Dalai Lama trip, but another time going up to Madison.
Mm.
So he became this very like sprawling kind of personality where he did all of these things. And in a way, they were all his work, but they were also, you know, his path to enlightenment too.
Right.
You know, sprawled. And I thought, okay, that's fascinating too. I find that inspiring, you know? So, you know, maybe I'll try to do something similar or something, right? Where I'll go through, I'll try to choose the work that's meaningful. I'll try to make it big, you know? And in that sense, that'll be my Zen or something, or that'll be my Tantra, right?
Yeah.
In that way. And I know if other people find that inspiring, I was inspired by that. You know, that spoke to me.
I there was somebody whom I was connected with some years ago, and I might have talked about her once on the podcast before, but she was a yogi in the way that you would imagine. She was a self-taught practice every day, 5 a.m. before work. She made all of her clothes. She baked bread, she did, you know, all these things, you know, that she did herself. And we talked about this kind of thing, you know, way back when. And I was like, how do you reconcile your career? Because she was just like, she worked admin, and I think at the University of Chicago. And I said, well, how do you, you know, that, how does that fit in, you know, this lifestyle that you have? And she's like, it doesn't. And that's the point. She's like, I don't have to, I go to work, I do whatever work there is to be done, and then I'm done. And I leave and I don't take it home. I don't have any responsibilities. I'm finished. And I get to be me more often than the time that I'm not. I have paid time off, sick days, 5 o'clock comes around, pop, I'm out of the office. That's it. And she's like, then I don't carry it with me. And I had never met anybody like that before, you know, who lived a particular kind of life that would, you would seem to be opposite of that, and very kind of free flowing art projects and community involvement. And the work was there, was chosen intentionally so that it didn't interfere with the other things that she was involved in. And I appreciated that choice. So while I am inspired by, you know, we live our lives the way that we want to, and I'm inspired by that, those kinds of stories, I also want to give this to other people who might not be able to do that for whatever reason at this time, to be able to say that, like, even if you can't, you can still live your life inspired, so long as you're doing it in a very kind of a mindful way, that your work is the thing that fuels your life. And I think what we're saying is, life is a thing that fuels your work. But they're two different positions, but you can end up in similar places if you're still aiming for that goal, you know, you can yeah, still I'm achieve like, it.
Like, I'm fascinated by this question, like throughout the entire podcast, and I'll probably throw this out. This is the end. No one's going to listen this long till the end of this thing.
Well, this, you know, the top 10%, 5% of people are here.
All right, here we go.
Congratulations.
So I've been thinking about like this phrase, and I'll probably drop it in other episodes, like the samsarometer, mm-hmm. like the meter of samsara.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have like a little Geiger counter that you can, oh, this is samsaric. Ding, 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 ding. It would start ticking away, you know, like if you're reading like radioactivity or something. That's samsaric. This is not samsaric. And you know, the whole idea of something being samsara, like, you know, the Buddhist point is samsara is a place that's not going to be satisfying.
Yeah. Right?
And we're in a samsara. But you know, part of what I think we're trying to do in the podcast is to say, okay, you can find your pockets of spiritual meaning and inspiration in samsara, right? I think that's, I don't know if we ever said that this in these exact words, but this is part of the goal of this whole thing for me and trying to share with people, hey, maybe you can find this too, this place in samsara where you can find your spots of spiritual meaning, whether that's in, like say, a very deep and meaningful relationship with someone. You know, you can make it not samsaric.
Yeah.
Pull it back. Make it not samsaric, and like have that be something that the two of you can share as your meaning, right? You can do that, right?
Yeah.
You can do that with your work. With any of these obstacles, maybe what you can do is you can take them and make them non-samsaric.
Yeah.
Samsaric, the samsarometer pops out and starts going beep, 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 beep. Then you start going, okay, this is getting samsaric. This has to get fixed.
Yeah.
You know, but you can use it in different parts of your life, right? I'm talking about here in the work thing, right? But you can use it maybe what we were talking about 2 weeks ago with your family or whatever these things are. Oh, this is getting samsaric. Let me be aware of this. You know, I'm going to get a sense of samsara, right? I'll develop an internal samsarometer, right? And if something seems samsaric, I'll do something about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think it's a little bit of like a leap of faith around this in a way, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But also
for
like sure. Also like a kind of a commitment, a commitment of the Shen, a commitment of the spirit to say, okay, I'm going to try this as much as I can. I'm going to go through and I'm going to try in all of my activities, which, you know, if we're going to live a lay person's life, a lot of our activities are going to overlap with these obstacles, you know, right? But I'm going to make it the non-samsaric version as much as possible with the belief that I can do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe at times you can have doubts. Like sometimes you feel like, well, can I make this work in a non-samsaric way? Can I make the work part of my life or the relationship part of my life or the family part of my life or whatever it is? Can I make that work non-samsaric? But I think that's the part of the goal of the podcast for me.
Yeah.
What the exploration is. The exploration is, can we have things where we can make them so they're not like this, right? And then we'll make them the non-samsaric version of this. The meter won't go off, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then those will be the things that will be the ones that will help you fly, right?
Yeah.
They'll be the ones that will help, you know, help the spirit soar, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
Because you've made those things and those will be edifying. And I'd like to hope my hope is in all of this, you know, and because we're trying to communicate this to other people. And I'm trying to say, okay, this is a thing. Let's all believe this is a thing. And we can do this, right? We don't have to just drown in this samsara. We can mold, at least in some ways, through our tantra, through our Zen, through our shamanism, through our Sufism, through our Kabbalah, whatever it is, we can
whatever
start to
mold
this samsara to be rewarding for us.
Yeah, right? through community service, through, you know, giving.
Yeah.
Charity.
Yeah, through healing arts, through whatever it is, right? We can make this non-samsaric. It's possible, right, to do this. And I, maybe that's like, for me, the closure of this was, of this particular part was like, yeah, that really, that idea really hits me, right?
Yeah.
And I, again, I think behind all of this conversations for me is this kind of goal. Like, listen, okay, it's samsara. Got it, right? But we don't have to succumb to that.
Right.
We can make it non-samsaric in our own ways, right? And throughout any of these things, we can transform them. We'll do the tantric transformation of these things and make them into something else. I know that seemed to be like something worthwhile talking about to me at the end of this whole thing. It just hit me.
Yeah. I think for me, the other part to remember is that, like, moving, you know, just, we're going to, you know, wrap it up here in a minute. The beginning of this episode, when we started talking about this, I started talking about recognition and the desire for connection. And since this is, you know, inevitably part of my DNA, you know, as a being, I find that it's always worth reminding to people, because I had this conversation around this topic in particular with many of my patients and clients and friends and, you know, just in general, because it's fascinating.
Yeah, I don't interrupt. Is that because people are troubled by this, right? That's the reason you're having some of these conversations.
It's a big thing.
It's causing, like, a lot of trouble, right?
Okay. Like, we could do another episode just on this. And maybe we will, you know?
Well, these things are going to keep coming up, right? This is so
yeah.
I didn't mean to bust your flow, but I was just like, yeah, because it is, you could just tell it's so deep for people.
So
they're struggling so much about this.
Yeah. And I think that part of it is that we spend so much time. I spend so much time. People do. At work, and the relationships that we have at work are oftentimes like a family. And like a family, there is dysfunction. The difference being is that, like, your punishment in this case is your livelihood and ability to pay for your life or feed your family or, you know, whatever, right? Depending on what part of that spectrum you're falling on when in your requirement for work, you know, that the financial dependency you have on that work, you know what I'm saying? But that, like, we don't often treat coworkers, I mean, some places do, but we don't treat them like people who are in our life, you know, they're just there. And what we're doing sucks so bad that they have to pay us to do it. I'm saying, like, this is so shitty. That, like, you have to bribe me to come here and do this thing. It's not that way for everybody, I understand, but for a lot of people, it really is.
I remember having to explain that to my kids, just going like, see, the reason why there was kind of like, why don't they pay teachers more? And that's because they don't have to, I was explaining. People want to do nice things for kids. You don't have to pay them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why don't you have to pay people in, like, even parts of the healing arts? Because people will do it because it's rewarding for them. They like it.
Yeah, that's right.
The shit that you don't want to do, they have to pay you a lot of money to do it because it sucks, you know, rots the soul on some level.
Yeah,
anyways,
for sure.
Yeah, what you're saying is so true. Yeah.
Yeah. And that, like, I think people forget about that, the community aspect, the connection aspect with their coworkers, and that, like, it is an opportunity to practice interpersonal communication with people who you don't have, like, deep connection with. You know, but why not build that thing? And of course, I can hear in my mind, well, you know, inner office dynamics and relationships and boundaries and, you know, whatever. But it's like, why would, you know, I come from being in the military where you don't know anybody, you know, you don't know anybody. And everybody comes from all these different walks of life. And for the most part, it's a pretty unified front. You know what I'm saying? And so you put down all the things that you know, have as a being, because you're wearing the same clothing and you're dealing with people, and you have to, the job that you're doing is of primary importance. And so you're going to work with the person who's in front of you to execute that particular thing, and you get to know them in the process. And, you know, there's always differences between people. I mean, not everyone's going to get along and all of that. But for me, it's such a missed opportunity that people skimp out on because they don't, you know, they just want to get it done or whatever it is. Why would we not take this opportunity to grow, take this opportunity to learn, you know, to practice being open-hearted or practice listening or practice whatever it is, you know, that we need practice with on these people that we spend so many hours with. We spend so much time with them. You spend more time with people at your work than you do with your own family. There's no question. You know what I'm saying? So like, why do we drudge through it? Why, you know, and I don't know. Just to me, it just never really, it never really made sense in my mind that people didn't take their work opportunity to grow in a deeper kind of sense. And I, my only thought on it is that they just don't like being there and nobody does.
Well, this is like part of your Daniel instinctive sense of like building Sangha. Why not build Sangha everywhere?
Why not?
You know, Sangha being like the community of people that kind of spiritually support one another, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Why not build Sangha all around you, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so even if it's at a workplace, okay, you know, they didn't build that office space to build a Sangha there, but like, why not? Why not do it? Why not transform that into a Sangha?
Why not? You know?
I could say like a couple of interesting things just on like a personal level about that,
sure.
what you're throwing out there, because I think I did try to do that. And I did make connections in surprising places. Like I worked in this very like right-wing conservative office when I was like in part of my undergrad and part of my grad school days.
Was that Breitbart?
Might as well have been. Honestly, seriously. And I was like, you know, the people were nice.
Sure.
You know, it's that's the irony of it. You know, you might disagree with people politically, but it doesn't mean they're not nice people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So we all have family members we disagree with. We're like, oh, that's a nice person. I just, mm-hmm. we just see the world through a different prism. But, you know, I got along with people, but I also found like kindred spirits there.
Yeah.
Right. So maybe that's the way that you find your kindred spirits.
Mm-hmm.
But I also would say one other thing about that, which was that once I got into work environments that kind of suited me more, it happened a little bit when I was doing my HIV work through Cook County Hospital, Rush Presbyterian, St. Luke. Mm. So I had a job where I worked for a number of years. I was on a grant, so I was doing public health, and I was working with all HIV and AIDS patients back in the day when that was a much more, the mm-hmm. health problems about that were much more severe, right, and consuming. Yeah. And I felt tied into that place, you know? And probably in some ways it was because there were, in a weird way, there were people I could really, from all over the world, and we bonded, you know? And I also felt that way when I started teaching, too. I felt like, okay, this is a community I can connect with. And I would say that I met like very, very dear and important people in my life, like you, like through those spaces.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so maybe the only other thing, like I wasn't thinking about this, you know, when we were planning on recording this, but now that you brought it up, maybe that's part of how you know you're in the right space. Because the people start to resonate with you.
Mm.
You're like, oh, I'm meeting important people in these spaces. Mm. You know, maybe I'm meeting some of the most important people in my life in these spaces. Because we're all being drawn into this same part of life.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe that's another way that you can kind of like use the samsarometer, right? Or whatever you want to do with it to start measuring this. Okay, this is probably more where I belong because I'm finding people that we're resonating. You know, not that's everybody, good... maybe.
Right. Yeah.
But it does tell you, like, I'm probably in the right space in life.
Yeah.
You know, that might be another feedback thing.
That's a good point.
Yeah, if it feels like I can't find the people here, I can't commune with these people, that might be an indication that you're not in the right space. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, I hadn't, you know, I'm glad you brought it up, that whole thing mm-hmm. of building community, because that's such a strong part of your personality,
mm-hmm.
right?
It's mm-hmm.
a deep part of who you are, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, like when I really thought about it, as you were talking, I was thinking about, what is my experience of this? And I was like, yeah, then I felt close with people in a very natural way. Going back to what you were talking before, the way that you can just be natural and have it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, it seems good, man.
Yeah, it is good. I like that.
It's good.
That's a good place to cap it right there.
Yeah. Thanks for all the deep thoughts, Daniel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Of course. No. This is we're in a good zone right now with this. This is a good thing. You know, we're in a good spot. So, I appreciate the efforts, my friend. Always.
Thank you, Daniel.
And we appreciate the audience. You know, whether you're watching us, you know, via video on YouTube, if you are, like, comment, subscribe, or just subscribe, or just like, or comment, or none, whatever, you know, those work. If you're catching us on one of the other ones, you know, Thank you for tuning in. Please, you know, share the work. We definitely appreciate it. You know, and anything that you can do in terms of leaving a comment or something like this, like, it just helps the show grow. So we definitely appreciate it. If, you're checking us out and you want to hit us up, you know, please do so, via email, ginandtantra@gmail.com. If you're, got the Instagram things, the Gin and Tantra podcast, you can, you know, hit us up there too. We always like to interact with people. If you have something you would like us to cover, or, you know, somebody you think we should interview, or, you know, a book or something like that, you know, please feel free. We're certainly not the end all be all to all things spirituality or life. I think the one of the other parts that we are trying to make clear is that spirituality is not just something that lives on a meditation cushion or inside of a temple or a, you know, a specific place, but your life is spiritual. You cannot, you can only ignore it if you want to, but you have to make effort. And so we'd rather make effort diving into it more deeply and you know, weaving it all together. Hence, Tantra, mean to weave, Gin and Tantra. We like things in twos. For Eric, this is Daniel. We'll catch you guys on the next one. Deuces. I want you to get together. I want you to get together. Put your hands together one time. I want you to get together. I want you to get together.